From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, July 5th through Friday, July 9th, 2021. It was a post-holiday week of intense heat in terms of the weather, the economy, and politics, or more specifically, climate change, inflation, and the left-right battle for the hearts, minds, and direction of America. Stand by as we're about to be joined by media thought leaders left, right, and center for a bold hour of Black Belt Talk Radio in which your tolerance for hearing different but legitimate points of view will be tested, so try not to get angry. During the next hour, you'll hear from accomplished talk media professionals, Dr. Dahlia Wax in Las Vegas, shedding light on the Delta variant, Steve Wiseman in Boston, analyzing former President Trump's lawsuits against big tech, Joyce Kaufman in South Florida, discussing the immediate and long-term implications of the Surfside condo disaster, Joe Madison in Washington, D.C., with an African-American perspective on critical race theory, and Mark Simone in New York City, dissecting the Big Apple mayoral primary election and the impact of increased crime on politics. Opinionated people from around the country with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices sharing their observations as well as the feelings of their target constituents with whom they do their daily dance of affirmation in a deafeningly noisy world in which we try to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap, heard coast to coast and around the world on great radio stations in the U.S. and U.K., an examination of the past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media. Information is gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. Okay, here we go. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10, the heat wave tied with climate change. The deadly heat wave maintains its grip on large segments of North America, inflicting severe damage upon California, not to mention the Pacific Northwest.
This past June was the hottest on record in North America since records have been kept. It's all part of an overall warming trend. The 7 warmest years in the history of accurate worldwide record keeping have been the last 7 years, and 19 of the 20 warmest years have occurred since 2000. Last year tied with 2016 as the hottest year on record according to meteorological studies.
At number 9, U.S. relations with China and Russia tied with the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Problems with China and Russia continue to grow on many fronts, from cyberspace security to geophysical military positioning and the crushing of domestic political opposition. In Afghanistan, the withdrawal of American troops per President Biden's plan continues, with expectations that the historically war-torn nation will descend back into chaos. But it is now the official Washington view that it's their problem, not ours.
Although it didn't make the talkers' top 10 topics, the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moise has generated buzz and concern on the talk shows of America as authorities in that tropical island nation round up at least 17 suspects, including 2 U.S. citizens. As the saying goes, to be continued.
At number 8, the New York City mayoral race tied with a spike in urban crime. Former policeman, state senator, and Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams is the winner of the complicated Democratic primary election in the nation's largest city, and he will face Republican nominee Curtis Sliwa in the general election.
Our sources in the Big Apple indicate that the spike in crime is far and away the major issue on the minds of New Yorkers. Both Adams and Sliwa have law and order as the main planks in their campaign platforms.
At number 7 this week, the southern border crisis tied with immigration reform. The humanitarian problem at the border is neither going away nor improving. It's just a matter of how much press attention it gets from week to week in the mainstream media.
Sometimes it seems that if it weren't for news talk radio in America and the attention given the matter by former President Donald Trump's administration, the need for immigration reform would be an invisible issue.
At number 6, race relations tied with critical race theory. The latest controversy in the ongoing subject of race relations in America has been conservative fear and indignation over the idea of critical race theory being taught in public schools.
We'll be discussing this issue on today's program, shedding light on it from the perspective of one of talk radio's leading African-American thought leaders.
At number 5, the aftermath of the Florida condo collapse. The Surfside, Florida tragedy has left grim statistics of broken lives and broken hearts in its wake, as any hope for locating survivors in the rubble has basically run out.
But the ripples of worry and fear have spread throughout the region, where there are literally hundreds of condominium buildings reaching the critical 40-year inspection mark. The impact on the South Florida housing market could be huge.
At number 4, the economy, inflation fears, and the infrastructure. Tragedy in South Florida has created heightened interest in the infrastructure and a new dimension in President Biden's economic recovery plan as it connects to investment in rebuilding and updating the nation's roads, bridges, tunnels, and now buildings.
On the economic front, inflation fears continue to brew, stemming from the rising cost of staples such as gas, food, and construction materials. Whether these stats are the to-be-expected short-term results of the pandemic and climate conditions, or symptoms of more severe long-term economic problems, remains to be seen.
At number 3, Trump sues social media and internet security issues. The former president has sparked even further discussion about social media bias by filing lawsuits against big media mega platforms Facebook, Twitter, and Google, claiming that they abridged his First Amendment rights by censoring him.
Although legal experts say this is more a political PR move on the part of Trump than it is a substantial legal maneuver, it could have consequential implications for the continuation of Section 230, which observers on both sides of the aisle claim is an outdated ruling in serious need of updating.
At number 2 this week, the GOP and Trumpism, tied with the January 6th committee. As the midterm election of 2022 draws closer and the presidential election of 2024 looms on the horizon beyond that, the GOP continues to wrestle with its balancing act relationship with the former president as the party's de facto leader and potential presidential nominee.
It's a matter of enjoying the benefits of Trump's huge base of support in the primaries or avoiding primaries altogether without suffering the downside of tying the party's fate in general elections to the former president's personal baggage, such as the potentially escalating criminal indictments filed against his organization and a nonstop stream of accusations and firsthand accounts in books and interviews from reporters, writers, and former colleagues about his authoritarian tastes and tendencies. The GOP's refusal to go along with a January 6 investigation can also have serious implications one way or another in the coming general elections.
And at number 1 this week, the COVID-19 Delta variant, vaccines, masks, and politics. Although general statistics indicate we are making tremendous headway in putting COVID-19 behind us, the coast is not yet clear in terms of the Delta variant, the efficacy of the various vaccines, and the politics of wearing masks seeking those to blame.
We'll be taking a deeper dive into this in just moments with one of the most trusted medical authorities in American talk radio. Stay right where you are. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged in to the Michael Harrison Wrap. COVID-19 remains at the top of the list of the most talked about topics this week. Just like we can't seem to fully shake the pandemic, we also can't stop talking about it. We're joined now by our medical correspondent. She's a medical doctor and talk show host heard daily across the nation out of Las Vegas, Nevada, on the Genesis Communications Network, Dr. Dahlia Wax. What should we know about the Delta variant at this point?
The Delta variant is concerning because it originated in India and seemed to decimate a good amount of the population there, with hundreds of thousands of cases being reported a day. And the Delta variant is one that's very transmissible, highly transmissible. They think it could be very infectious. It could evade immunity, some of our monoclonal antibody treatments, but it also seems to also hit the younger population, the younger, healthier population. So Delta is a huge concern for us in America because for those who are unvaccinated, they might think, well, I'm young, I didn't get hit with the first waves of COVID. Delta variant might attack those very groups of people.
It seems to be broken down by party line, which means it's still politicized.
Well, it's interesting. You know, with Dr. Fauci had brought up a comment about people not vaccinating should not make a political statement. But as a doctor, being licensed in Mississippi and Alabama, many people are Democrat and liberal who also aren't getting vaccinated. So I don't think the vaccinated versus the unvaccinated is along party lines. And in fact, I think there's a lot of people out there that don't want to be accused of being Republican or Democrat based on their vaccination choice. So I've been asking people, and I was a little shocked that Fauci as a physician would do that, would almost assume that people who weren't vaccinating were supporters of, let's say, President Trump, because so many President Trump supporters got vaccinated and so many people who are unvaccinated have concerns, such as studies that involved African Americans and if enough African Americans were represented in the country, in the studies, and distrust of the vaccine and medicine in general of certain minorities. But also a big issue is patients in Mississippi and Alabama and some of these states, they don't have easy access to a provider. So one patient told me, if I get the vaccine and I have a side effect, where do I go? The ER is too expensive. I'll just wait. And so many people's reasons for hesitation have nothing to do with who the president is.
Is there any statistics, or do you have any information or opinion about the efficacy in dealing with the Delta variant in terms of the different vaccines that have been out there from the different companies?
Fantastic question. So we believe that the vaccine is working, because if not, so many more people would be infected with the Delta variant today in America. Israel had said that the Delta variant is lowering the efficacy of the vaccine down to the 60% range, 68% range. However, it's still at least 92% effective at keeping people away from the hospital and dying of COVID, which is success, which is exactly what we're aiming for. So I'm pretty confident that the vaccine we have is going to provide protection against the Delta variant.
The mask issue, where do you stand on that?
So I'm a fan of the N95 respirator masks. Those masks are the ones that have been proven to be effective against a virus such as coronavirus. I'm not a fan of these sparkly, glittered, sequined, lacy, bandana-type face coverings that people are using that have been sitting in their pockets and then being put back on their face. And so in terms of masks, masks do provide a barrier and will probably be the most effective during the cough, cold, sneezing, spewing season. But in terms of being able to fight COVID and the Delta variants, I think our biggest weapon is going to be the vaccine.
The Olympics is certainly something that's bringing attention on an international level to the COVID-19 era. What are your thoughts about what's happening in Japan?
Great. So this was, I mean, I really feel bad for Tokyo, you know, putting at least $15 billion into the Olympics and not being able to have spectators. But what is very indicative of what's going on with Tokyo and the variant means this isn't an American Republican Democrat conspiracy theory sort of thing. This shows that if a country is willing to, you know, lose billions of dollars for the safety of others for COVID, it shows that this is still a global threat. What is, though, interesting and intriguing is the Beijing Olympics is going to follow 6 months later. And we've been so preoccupied with the Tokyo Olympics, we forget that the next Olympics is coming up right around the corner. And Beijing, remarkably, China, remarkably, doesn't seem to have the case spike like Mongolia does, like South Korea does, like Japan does. So I understand why Tokyo is making that move, and my guess is they're making that move based on a lot of data in terms of cases. But it does make me wonder how China throughout this time is looking pretty much pandemic-free, and then will we have the same transparency when we need to get ready for the Beijing Winter Olympics? A lot of Americans want to go to the Olympics, and if Beijing is having an outbreak similar to Japan but not being very transparent about it, it could then become a huge hotspot and perpetuate a 2022 COVID wave.
How about these other countries in terms of their vaccines? I know that Russia has its own vaccine. China has its own vaccine. I'm not quite sure about the rest of the world, but what about the Russian and the Chinese vaccines? Have you heard anything about them?
Yes. CNBC did an analysis looking at China's vaccine, the Sinovac and Sinopharm vaccine. It's an inactivated vaccine, similar to the way we do our flu shot. And China has touted that they've been doing well. They have no deaths, hardly any cases, and they're rocking and rolling. Yet CNBC did an analysis and found that 5 of the 6 countries having spikes in cases used China's vaccine. So, again, that starts to bring up the transparency. I don't know if America's doing any tests on the efficacy of the vaccine because we're just so overwhelmed with, you know, following our Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson. But right now, CNBC has kind of alluded to there's some skeptics out there on how effective the China vaccine is.
That's our medical correspondent, Dr. Dahlia Wax of the Genesis Communications Network. Coming up next, a look at the most talked about aspects of cyberspace this past week, including social media bias, Trump's lawsuit, and more. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. One of the great bands of the golden age of album rock, Gun Hill Road, has been around for more than 50 years. The members of Gun Hill Road are Steve Goldrich, Paul Reich, Glenn Leopold, Brian Coonan, and yours truly, Michael Harrison. I wrote the lyrics to a song on our new album, What Year Is This? It's titled, I Know You're Real. It's about the relationship between human beings and our friends in the animal kingdom.
I know you're real.
Take a moment to write down the following web address to see the music video of this inspirational song that contains some wonderful animal images that'll rock your heart and soothe your soul. Here's the address. Write it down. IKnowYouAreReal.com. That's IKnowYouAreReal.com. If you love animals, you'll feel real good after seeing this video. IKnowYouAreReal.com. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap. It's been another week of cyberspace stuff being discussed in the talk media. Topping the list is former President Trump suing Facebook, Twitter, and Google for allegedly abridging his First Amendment rights by censoring him. Joining us now is our cyber law correspondent, Steve Wiseman. He's a professor of law at Bentley University in Boston, a prolific author, and the founder of one of the nation's foremost anti-cybercrime websites, Scamicide.com. Let's start with Trump suing Facebook, Twitter, and Google. What are your thoughts about that?
You know, when I first heard about the lawsuit, I thought this is absolutely ridiculous. And from a legal standpoint, it really is. There is no basis. And one of the things when former President Trump talks about suing them and freedom of speech, freedom of speech and the First Amendment protect you from the interference in your rights of freedom of speech from the government. So, for instance, there is no right to speak on talk radio. You know, I remember Don Imus years ago used to dismiss certain callers who would say, you know, I have a First Amendment right. And he said, you want a First Amendment right? Get your own darn 50,000-watt radio station. So the bottom line is, legally, this stands not a scintilla of a chance of being successful. They are not part of the government. They have absolutely every right under federal law to not allow him to be on their platforms. However, as a political move, it's probably pretty savvy. He doesn't have to win. First of all, he's using it as a way of fundraising, and it's actually being pretty effective for him. It also is another way for him to, in effect, campaign and get a message out. And picking on the big tech and the social media platforms is certainly not a dangerous thing for anyone. It's hard to find anyone who really loves the social media platforms. So legally, no. there isn't the snowball's chance in hell of this ever being successful in court. And as a matter of fact, it'll probably get tossed out quite early in the process. It will never go to a trial. It will have what's called a summary judgment, and that is where the defendants in this case will say that as a matter of law, there's no basis for the suit, and a court will agree. But as a publicity matter, as something to raise funds, it's going to be effective for them.
You know, I often get frustrated when people who should know better don't know that basic fundamental fact about the First Amendment in terms of it provides you with protection from government censorship as opposed to private platform censorship. As a matter of fact, the First Amendment protects anyone who has a private platform from having anyone else force themselves on that platform, which would be a form of tyranny, actually.
Yeah.
You know, but so on one level, I say, how could somebody who was president of the United States not know that? But then, of course, when you point out, well, he knows that. It's just a political method and taking advantage of the fact that the big platforms are not all that popular. That, you know, people know there's something is wrong with the power that they wield, although it may not be a First Amendment issue, but it does bring up Section 230.
Yeah.
And that I could see being arguable, and that for those who, you know, are not following this closely, Section 230 basically provides the Facebooks of the world with a lot of protection that maybe is outdated at this point. So what are your thoughts about Trump's impact on Section 230 with this maneuver?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. You know, when you look at the country that is so divided between left and right, progressives, conservatives, Republicans, and Democrats, is there anything that they can agree on? And quite frankly, Section 230 may be one of the things upon which they can agree on. It doesn't appear that any politician, no matter the side, is very happy with Section 230. You got to go back, and you mentioned outdated, and that's the key thing with this. Section 230 was bipartisan legislation that came about in 1996. The internet's early days, and there was a concern, and a legitimate concern, that if you have a website, are you going to be liable if someone publishes something on your website that is, oh, it could be slanderous, it could be defamation, it could be, you know, any kind of violation of the law. And this is different from a newspaper, because, say, a newspaper, they control very, very tightly what gets on their platform. But when you're looking at large websites and social media, you know, so much comes in, how could they possibly be able to police everything, particularly in 1990? Before you had artificial intelligence and algorithms that could screen things. So the law seemed to make sense at that time, but you're absolutely correct. It does need some tinkering. It doesn't have to be thrown out completely, but I do think that some further fine-tuning of that to bring it up to date with what the realities are today, I think is legitimate. And, you know, you have former President Trump that wanted to take action against Section 230. You have President Biden who's saying he doesn't even want to tinker with it. He said it should be abolished. It'll be a slow change that we see with it, but it will come.
Getting Congress to understand it is an issue. I think Trump understands it. I'm not sure that that Congress understands it. Let's pivot real quickly. We don't have much time to the ransomware issue that just keeps on coming, and you know, it just seems every day becomes more dangerous to do any kind of business on the internet. And of course, it's deadly not to do business on the internet. So we're all caught between a rock and a hard place. What's the latest on everything from Microsoft issuing a warning that you better update now or you're going to have some type of terrible thing happen, or this latest in malware, in ransomware?
Yeah, and you know, when you said we don't have much time, we as a society don't have much time. This most recent attack at ransomware by Russian-sponsored, they were private, not government, but Russian hackers against Kaseya is what they call a supply chain attack. And what that means is they don't go after the company directly. They go after a company that you deal with that may supply you with software that you trust. Now, this was the tactic that was used by the Russian government with SolarWinds. They got into the Justice Department. They got into all kinds of government agencies. This is a huge, huge problem. Now, supposedly, representatives of Russia and the United States have been talking about how to deal with this since Biden and Putin met. Whether something's going to come from this, we don't know. This was not an attack, this most recent one, on our infrastructure, which is what Biden said will not be tolerated. But for small to medium-sized businesses, big businesses, and people, this is an existential threat. You can be put out of business, you can lose all your money, and a lot of it is because people just aren't taking the proper steps. Congress has not enacted regulations because too many companies were able to buy their influence and say, we don't want regulations. This is real serious stuff.
That's law professor Steve Weissman of Bentley University in Boston discussing aspects of cyberspace that were in the national conversation this past week. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Let's pivot now to South Florida, where the aftermath of the disastrous, tragic Surfside condo collapse has not only broken lives and hearts, but it's having a huge impact on both the heads and wallets of a gigantic industry and lifestyle. Condominiums. I know. I live in a South Florida condo for a portion of the year, as does our guest. She hosts a daily program on WFTL, whose powerful signal covers Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and the Palm Beaches. That's condo country. Joyce Kaufman. Joyce, this Surfside condo collapse has really gripped people. It's a tragedy, and it's terribly, terribly sad, but in the aftermath, beyond the sadness, it's left a lot of confusion and a lot of concern in the minds and of so many people who live in similar places. I've been up in the Northeast. I have a place in Florida, as you know, but you're down there. How has it impacted the public and the people, especially people who live in condos in South Florida?
Well, as you also know, I'm one of those people who live in condos in South Florida, and within 48 hours, everyone in my development had received a notice through our email that our buildings were 40 years old, which is the magic number when all buildings have to go through a very close look by the authorities to see if there are any obvious dangers that need to be remedied so we would not see a collapse or anything of that nature. So immediately you could see fear struck in the hearts of, you know, my community has close to 2,000 people living in it, and every single one of them was talking about it in the elevators and on the sidewalks and in their, you know, parking lots. So it has truly affected us. Now, you have to understand, Florida's been open far longer than other cities around the country. So we got back to normal and we stopped living with this constant fear of COVID before you guys up in the Northeast or out West did. So to see the resurgence of fear in the eyes of my neighbors has really been dramatic. It's made me very sad.
The condo associations, the whole structure of condos, to people that don't live in condos or co-ops, there's a leap of faith when you buy into a thing like that, that the association and the board members are all competent and that they're going to be doing the right thing. There's the constant struggle between doing the right thing, keeping the thing up to speed, maintaining it, and saving money, because there's that thing called the assessment. And we at the place that I have lived in part-time for the past 20-some-odd years, north of Surfside, up in Palm Beach County, the repairs were already underway for concrete restoration. It, too, is a building that's about 40 years old. And what happens with the particular weather there and everything, not to mention who knows how shoddy these things were constructed to begin with contractors and inspectors and, you know, their relationships. This thing was going on and on and on. Every time they turn around, they found another problem. And the assessment has gone into the thousands. And the people are grumbling and all upset. And then all of a sudden this happens. And yeah, right. We received our letters and all of that too. This is a big eye-opener for a lot of people who just didn't fully understand what it's like to live in that type of a situation where you are in fact responsible. You're responsible for the building and for the home. And you're dealing with, in some cases, hundreds, maybe thousands of partners. So, what you're describing is a big eye-opener, and I'm experiencing the very same thing. Where do you think it's going to go from here? Do you think this is going to affect real estate prices in Florida? Do you think that this is going to change the culture, or it's just going to create a little more diligence?
Oh, I think it's going to be a dramatic change. First and foremost, the property insurance market is already in upheaval here in Florida. So, you're going to see higher premiums for condo insurance, which affects people on fixed incomes dramatically, which is the preponderance of people who live in South Florida condominiums. You're also going to see insurance companies evaluating inspection companies to make sure they're looking at the right companies so that you don't have a disaster. And, of course, my biggest concern is you're going to have all these carpetbaggers, engineers, and contractors pouring in from other states to fill a void that's going to be created by local politicians and the demands by insurance companies. So if you think your HOA cost is high now, wait until next year. The real estate market may take a real serious hit, just as Governor DeSantis is going for re-election. And I know the other side, they will use the condo collapse and regulations, do Republicans put in enough of them, as a cudgel against a very popular governor in an upcoming election. So it's got a lot of ramifications for us.
Doesn't everything today become a political weapon in terms of politics? You'd think that this would be something that, you know, both parties could agree on. But no, you're right. Everything becomes a political weapon. Well, it's just fascinating to watch because real estate is hot all over the country, and so many people who are retired or looking to Florida as a way to preserve their nest egg, maybe build it a little bit, and enjoy their lives, are facing this very complex and frightening scenario.
You know, we're hopeful that we'll be able to provide a place where people still will be able to afford to live, particularly seniors. You know, we are proud of the fact that we have one of the highest senior populations in the world, not just in America, and that we care and take good care of our seniors. So I don't anticipate too many things happening to interfere with that, and that's a good thing. The bad thing, of course, is that for the young working people in Florida, things are going to get tougher. They're going to be expected to pick up a lot more in terms of regulations. There are going to be more regulations now.
That's Joyce Kaufman, host of a daily talk show on WFTL in South Florida. Coming up next, conversations about two terms that there's a good chance you have not heard used until the past several weeks: ranked choice voting and critical race theory. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap.
Some mistakes you just can't fix, like your retirement. You only get one chance, and with Grace Advisors, we'll help you make the most out of your one chance at a great retirement. At Grace Advisors, we make sure your retirement income is not at risk with the up and down ride of the stock market roller coaster. Instead, we build a foundation for your retirement, where when the market's up, you're up. When the market's down, you lose nothing, and we structure your plan in a way that you will save more on taxes. giving you an even greater return on your nest egg. So speak with the Grace Advisor, a Christian company, helping families protect their future every day. Call 888-585-1615. That's 888-585-1615. Call 888-585-1615 and speak to a Grace Advisor today. Or visit graceadvisors.com/radio.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. The subject of race relations has been a top 10 topic on the talk shows of America since the Great Reckoning of 2020 began well more than a year ago in the midst of an emerging pandemic. The latest fireworks have been over what many conservatives perceive as the serious constitutional threat of an academic concept called critical race theory being taught in the schools. Joining us now is one of the nation's most respected and influential African-American thought leaders, the host of the morning show on SiriusXM's Urban View channel, an inductee of the Radio Hall of Fame, not to mention longtime top 10 ranked member of the Talkers Heavy 100, the Black Eagle, Joe Madison.
I'm laughing about this whole critical race theory, and I'll tell you why I'm laughing.
Why?
I don't know what the hell it is or was until I first heard it being bannered about by people who also probably didn't know what it is or was, and it's in a way... It's hilarious because it's I've learned since it's nothing new. It pretty much was taught in law schools, and all this concern that we can't allow it to be taught in our public schools to our children, Michael. You've got law students who don't understand it, mm-hmm. and let alone teachers in public schools trying to teach it. And I'll say this too: most people, black and white, really haven't been properly taught black history, let alone something as complicated as quote-unquote critical race theory. So people ought to just quit it and realize that they're demonizing it because, quite honestly, they don't want a new generation to understand, you know, all of American history, not just one aspect of it.
A lot of white people believe that they are not personally racist and are frightened by the idea of being lumped into that. What do you have to say to them?
Well, what I say to that is you're absolutely right. They personalize any criticism of what this country has or has not done, particularly to minorities. And I think you're absolutely right. I think any time that there's anything negative, honest about history, they then internalize it. You can't internalize what Andrew Jackson did to Native Americans. You can't internalize the Supreme Court did with Plessy versus Ferguson. You analyze the history, and the purpose of the analysis is to correct it, particularly if it has an inequitable impact on any group of people. And so I would say to white America, you know, quit internalizing every aspect of history and learn from it, and hopefully we grow to make sure that we don't repeat the same mistake.
What conversation do you have with your black listeners, which I understand is a diverse bunch, about this latest, you know, issue in terms of race relations that's talked about in the media?
I would start the conversation with them the same way that I started it with you. First of all, let's get real. First of all, you probably didn't learn much of your history in school, even if you went to a predominantly black school. Secondly, understand that you need to not allow any aspect of our society to undervalue, underestimate, and marginalize you. My philosophy, and I didn't really evolve to this. This has been my philosophy because I was brought up this way. No one is any better or any worse than you are, Joseph, because of the color of your skin. Mm-hmm. And don't let anybody convince you of that. And that's what I teach my children. That's what I tell my audience. And that has been my philosophy. But we live in a society where, unfortunately, I think there are just a group of people, and I think, quite honestly, a small group of people, but they're very vocal, who still feel that whiteness means domination. And it's not good enough, Michael, for people to say, well, I'm not racist. What you have to understand is you must be anti-racist. So what are you doing to make sure that racism doesn't exist? But I say to black listeners as well as white listeners, this is about equal opportunity. This is about being the best that you can be, and don't let anybody convince you otherwise. And that's my message to Black America. But when it comes, and I'm laughing about this critical race theory, and let me just put it very simply, that is a highfalutin academic exercise that pretty much started in the 1970s and maybe even before that with the writings of W.E.B. Du Bois and Fannie Lou Hamer. We unfortunately, I think because of this social media and instant communication, somebody, you know, comes up with a slogan like critical race theory. And I would bet you my conservative colleagues in talk radio and on the other side, I bet you they've not read one legal review about this issue. I bet you they haven't read one book about it. And Michael, if I'm willing to admit I haven't, then they ought to do the same thing. Or shut up.
That's Joe Madison, the morning host of SiriusXM Satellite Radio's Urban View channel and Radio Hall of Famer. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Okay, we have time for one more. The New York City Democratic Party's recent primary election for mayor stumbled out of the block in utilizing a complex new system of casting and counting ballots called ranked choice voting, in which people vote for several candidates for the same office based on their order of preference. The slow process of tallying the vote with this system was further impaired when it was revealed that there was a discrepancy in the counting itself and validity of many of the ballots. Well, to make a very long story short, they fixed the errors, and the winner of the Democratic nomination turned out to be the same guy they originally thought was on his way to winning it. Former policeman, state senator, and Brooklyn Borough president Eric Adams, who'll be facing GOP nominee Curtis Sliwa in the general election. Joining us now is a longtime observer of all things Big Apple, WOR radio talk show host Mark Simone. What's your take on Eric Adams, and what should the people listening to this program around the country know about a man who seems to be on a fast track now to being the next mayor of New York?
He's a wonderful guy in person. I've known him for years. He's a very charming guy, a lot of personality, a lot of charisma, very likable. He was a cop for about, I think, 20 years. If you talk to top people in the police department, they're not very high on him. You keep hearing about this corruption allegation, that corruption allegation. I know he was going to go to a departmental trial at one point and resigned before that happened. Obviously, he was planning a political career, so he didn't want that on his record. So, and who knows if this will all come out in the campaign, but a very questionable record in the police department. He's said all the right things the last 4 months. He's really said all the right things about fighting crime, bring back the anti-crime unit, and bring back a modified stop and frisk. He calls it spot checks, but this is what everybody wanted to hear. However, if you go back 2 years ago, he was saying all the opposite. He was testifying against the police, testifying against these programs. So that's the only problem with him. We don't quite know what to believe. Also, you said on the fast track. That's because everybody will say a Republican has no chance. The city's 5-1 Democrat. There's no way a Republican. Let's bear in mind, Republicans have won 5 of the last 7 mayoral races. Always keep that in mind.
Well, I have gone on record as loosely predicting that Curtis Sliwa would win this election. Now, yeah. I have to say loosely because I'm not an expert at this point on New York City politics, and I am aware that we have in this case a Democrat running on a platform that anywhere else might be a Republican. He has a lot of conservative issues, and he's strong on the anti-crime position, and he's an African-American, which gives him a little more capital with getting away with stuff that perhaps Rudy Giuliani would have been called, a tyrant back when he took over after Dinkins. So the moon and the stars seem lined up for him, but knowing Curtis Sliwa the way I do and you do, Curtis Sliwa, for those listening, and we've mentioned it before on the show, is a not only a member of the Guardian Angels, the founder of it, but he's a very well-known New York radio personality, and he's a lot of fun. But I was thinking when you were saying that there's some spotty, questions about Adams' record, you can be sure that Curtis Sliwa was going to talk about it. I think he'll be an effective campaigner. What do you think?
He's got a lot of advantages that other Republicans don't have. Curtis was always very anti-Donald Trump. I don't remember exactly why, but because of that, there's no way you can tie any Trump stuff to him, so he doesn't have to worry about that. He's like me. He's conservative on some things. He's pretty liberal on other things, so he's not a conservative. Mm-hmm. The ethnic groups love him. If you walk around Manhattan right now, even in Chinatown, you see Curtis signs everywhere, so got a lot of ethnic appeal. That's very important right now for a Republican. And he's been a crime fighter since he was 5 years old. And some people say, well, why does he have to keep wearing that red beret? But every time you look at that red beret, all you think of is him patrolling the subways. This is the big thing, right? Maybe the biggest thing in New York right now. People want to be able to be safe on the subways again. And I know Eric Adams was a transit cop, but people think of those guardian angels and they think of safe subways. And also remember, as you know, Curtis Sliwa is one of the greatest debaters on earth. He's done 1 billion debates. Eric Adams is not the most articulate guy. Curtis most likely will slaughter him in 2 debates. That's a big factor.
Right. So you, like me, think that there's a chance that Curtis could pull this off and have an upset victory.
Oh, absolutely. And again, Republicans won 5 of the last 7. Mm-hmm. The other big important factor, there are many people that will never pull a Republican lever in a voting booth. But, and this is how Bloomberg won the last time, Curtis got himself on the independent ballot. That's how Bloomberg won, and that's how Curtis will win.
So he's running on two party lines, the Republican and the independent. Is there an independent? Is that a party line or is it a write-in?
No, it's a big party line. It's a big part of the ballot. In fact, Bloomberg, it was so important, spent $275 million to get himself on the independent line. Just shows you the skill of Curtis. He got on there for free. So, and a lot of New York. That's how Bloomberg won the last time. Most people who voted for him voted on the independent line, which is easy to do in any voting booth.
That's talk show host Mark Simone of WOR Radio in New York. And that concludes this latest installment of our show. This has been the Michael Harrison Wrap, looking back at the past week of Monday, July 5th through Friday, July 9th, 2021. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. And that does it for this week's installment of The Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications in conjunction with Talkers Magazine and Talk Media Network. Copyright 2021, all rights reserved.